page 338 of your exegetical outline notes. Page 338. Now, I do have, as promised, I do have this time frame charts for you. I finally got it done, so I'll be handing out this chart here for you. And we'll use it as kind of a review for this evening. Whoops, can I get a, I think I gave you a little bit too many there. Give me a few of those back. Okay. This is the long row right here. Okay, everybody got one? Okay, any extras? Thank you. All right, everybody have a chart? Okay, we're in, we're going to start chapter 11. Oh, look at that. Get out of there, you. All right, we're going to start chapter 11 this evening. We've been in a section, chapters 9 and 10, that dealt with the time of Jacob's trouble, the tribulation period, Yeshua's second coming, and the Messianic kingdom. And I've been showing you a chart in which these were broken down into different time periods, but as I taught through that, I thought, well, gee, this is so merged together that I ought to merge all the boxes together as well. So chapters 9 and 10, all the events of Jacob's trouble and the second coming of the Messianic kingdom are just kind of combined in there, and you jump back and forth so quickly between them that I just made it one big box. Anyway, we learn in chapters 9 and 10 that Israel will go through a time of discipline, the time of the tribulation. The tribulation, of course, is the time of God's judgment upon the world and especially upon his people. But we will be rescued out of the time of Jacob's trouble by Yeshua's second coming, and then he will institute the Messianic kingdom. But now at this point, after showing us, listen, here's where I'm going to take you. I'm going to take you to the Messianic kingdom. Remember back here in chapter 9, the Maccabean victories. I saved you from the Maccabees. I mean, I saved you from the Greeks here. I'll save you from the Antichrist here. And Antiochus Epiphanes prefigures the Antichrist. The man who brings the abomination of desolation upon Israel. I've saved you from Antiochus here. I'll save you from a greater Antiochus in the future. But now, let's go back. Let's rewind a little bit. Let's back up a little bit. And let's take a look at an event that has an incredible and important impact upon all that I'm going to do for Israel. So we back up to chapter 11, verse 1, and the rejection of the true shepherd. So we're going to jump back to this very, very important point. And there's a drastic and total change in tone and subject when we get to chapter 11, verse 1. Chapter 10, verse 12, we learn that the world will be judged and that the Jewish people will be strengthened. They'll walk in the Lord, in verse 12, and they will walk in his name. So that's a very positive picture. But now as we go to chapter 11, verse 1, listen to the tone change. Open your doors, O Lebanon, that fire may feed on your cedars. Verse 2. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen, because the glorious trees have been destroyed. So from a time of victory now to a time of defeat. Now if you look at this section of Scripture in commentaries, you will see that commentators are very undecided on how to approach verses 1 through 3. They can't decide whether to take a literal or a figurative approach. But I think the answer to the dilemma of verses 1 through 3 lies in the fact that 1 through 3 is a summary statement of the process that's going to lead to the dispersion of the Jewish people throughout the world. So it's a process that's summarized in three verses here. And then the two key elements of that process are detailed as we get into verse 4 and then a little later on in the chapter. So I think this is an overview. Bonnie.
What did you say? It's a summary of the process of what?
It's a summary of the process that's going to lead to the worldwide diaspora, the worldwide scattering of the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years. When we're done, your question will be answered. Okay? So look, I would suggest that you look at it that way. Okay, we begin with point 1A and the reference to Lebanon there. Open thy doors, O Lebanon. What is this? Now, in Jewish thinking, this is a figurative reference to the temple. Open your doors that fire may devour your cedars. This was interpreted as a prediction of the temple's destruction. In other words, the temple is opening its doors, opening its protection to the enemy, and saying, invaders, you are quite free to come in and destroy me. And the doors of the temple were quite heavy. It took quite a number of men to push them open and closed. Now, this is the... In the Talmud, Yomah 39a, I believe I already gave this out to you. Here again is that interpretation by the rabbis. Our rabbis taught during the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, so they date when this happened. They date this when? They date it in AD 30, right? 40 years before AD 70, which would be AD 30. What happened in AD 30? Yeshua was rejected and crucified. Okay? So from the time that Yeshua was rejected and crucified until the destruction of the temple, a number of supernatural events occurred, according to the rabbis. During the last 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the lot for the Lord, this is the lot, the Yom Kippur lot, did not come up in the right hand. In other words, when the two scapegoats were chosen, one for the Lord and one for Azazel, the lot for the Lord came up in the left hand. 40 straight times. That was considered a bad omen when the lot came up in the left hand. When it came up in the right hand, the rabbis considered it positive. So the lot for the Lord did not come up in the right hand, nor did the crimson-colored strap become white. That's a reference to the crimson-colored strap that was tied around the scapegoat. And Jewish tradition states that it became white when the scapegoat was pushed off into the wilderness, signifying that the sins of Israel had just been forgiven through the means of the Yom Kippur sacrifice. So that's the tradition. And for 40 years, the crimson color strap did not become white, indicating that the sins of Israel were not being forgiven through the Yom Kippur sacrifices. Nor did the westernmost light shine. That's a reference to the menorah, the lampstand in the holy place. The westernmost light was kept shining, kept burning 24 hours a day. Yet for 40 years it would keep blowing out. And the doors of the Heikal, this is the key that we're looking at for chapter 11, verse 1. And the doors of the Heikal, that's just another Hebrew word for the temple. The doors of the Heikal, the temple, would open by themselves. These huge, massive bronze doors that took a number of strong men to open, according to tradition, would open by themselves. And they kept opening until Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai rebuked them, saying, Heikal, Heikal, why wilt thou be the alarmer thyself? I know about thee that thou wilt be destroyed. So he interpreted this event as a symbol of the destruction of the temple. How did he know it? How did he come to that conclusion? Here's his reason. Because Zechariah ben Iddo, there's our man we're studying, Zechariah ben Iddo has already prophesied concerning the open thy doors, O Lebanon, that the fire may devour thy cedars. So there's verse 1 there, interpreted by the Jewish community as a portent of the temple's destruction. Now this fellow, Yochanan ben Zakkai, is very important. This is the rabbi who was caught in Jerusalem during the siege by the Romans, and he escaped from Jerusalem by faking his death. They put him in a coffin. They painted his toes blue. They put rotten meat all around him so he would stink. And then his disciples came to the gate and they said to the zealots, we got to bury our Rebbe. Now the only people being allowed outside of Jerusalem by the zealots at that time were those who were burying people. So they took one sniff and they looked at these blue toes and they thought, well, he's dead, so they let him go out. He went, the legend has it, he went directly over to Vespasian, and he prophesied that Vespasian would become the emperor. And when that happened, Vespasian said to him, what should I give you? And he said, give me Yavne. And Vespasian gave him the town of Yavne on the coast. And at Yavne, he set up a yeshiva, a rabbinical seminary. And in that yeshiva, he restructured rabbinic Judaism so that it was a religion that did not need the temple or the sacrificial system. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, by the way, he was a contemporary of Yeshua. He was probably, he was a Pharisaic missionary to Galilee. He was probably among the men who questioned Yeshua regarding his validity as Messiah. And he is one of the rabbis that rejected Yeshua, probably face to face. But anyway, he restructured rabbinic Judaism into a totally different religion, the religion that we have today, a religion that does not need the temple or sacrifices. So it's really quite ironic that he would be recorded here in Jewish tradition as well. So the opening the doors of Lebanon, a reference to the destruction of the temple. Why would the temple be called Lebanon? That's because there was a lot of cedar wood associated with the temple. For example, in 1 Kings 5, when Solomon is building the Solomonic Temple, not this particular temple, cedar beautified the inside of the temple. Solomon says in 1 Kings 5, "Behold, I intend to build a house for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to David my father, saying, your son, whom I will send on your, who I will set on your throne in your place, he will build the house for my name. Now, therefore, says Solomon, command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon." And so these beautiful cedars were cut and adorned the temple, and so the temple got this name back in Solomon's day as Lebanon, a reference to the beauty in the inside of the temple. And that name stuck. So there's going to be a devastation of the temple, and of course that devastation in verse 1 would include the surrounding territory of Jerusalem and Judah, but the focus here is on the temple. There will be a destruction of the temple. As we move into the second part of verse 2, we come to a reference of Bashan, a reference to Bashan. "Wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down." That probably is a figurative reference to the priesthood, the spiritual leadership of the nation. They are mourning the temple's destruction. They should have been like mighty oaks of Bashan, but instead they were wailing the destruction of the temple. Now, as during the first Jewish revolt, there's, as far as I know, there's no evidence that the Romans came down and did a scorched earth policy on Bashan and destroyed all the trees there. So I think this is a figurative reference to the priesthood. Moving on to the beginning of verse 3, we have a reference to the shepherds. This is on page 339. Page 339, first part of verse 3. "There is the sound of the shepherds' wail, for their glory is ruined. There is the sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined." Now, the voice of the wailing of the shepherds is again probably a figurative reference to the political leadership of Israel. The leadership of Israel is often called shepherds. That's a common term for them in the Scripture. So it could very well be so here. I don't think these are literal shepherds, because literal shepherds didn't have a lot of glory. They were very low on the social ladder. So I think this is a reference to the political leadership. Why? Because Jerusalem, the political capital of the country, and the temple where the political leadership met was destroyed. Now, when we come to the last part of verse 3, there's a reference to the Jordan Valley. "There is a sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined." Now, this is probably a reference, if I'm going to be consistent here, probably a reference to the royal princes of the Davidic house. the young lions, probably a reference to the royal princes of the Davidic house. There were a number of them around. They weren't allowed to reign. They had no power at that time. Matthew was one of them, probably one of the most humble of them.
In New Testament Matthew?
Yeah. Joseph.
Oh.
Joseph. Well, there were a number of them around, and after the first Jewish revolt, Vespasian went after the house of David and tried to destroy the remainder of the house of David because he considered them a political threat. So Joseph was not the only descendant of David who was around in the first century. No, I'm talking of Joseph, the guardian of Yeshua. Joseph from the house of David.
Mary's
husband. Okay, because he was from the house of David, from Solomon's line, and Mary from Nathan's line.
Bob, does the word pride here have a double meaning? Because the pride of lions is a family of lions. The pride of Israel is ruined.
I doubt it. I can look it up at the break, but I'm sure they're two separate Hebrew words there. Not like in English where the same word, same spelling, but totally different meanings. Okay. Now, while the Romans did not follow a scorched earth policy that would be required by a very literal interpretation of verses 1 through 3, they did devastate some areas. They didn't devastate Galilee during the first Jewish revolt particularly, but they did hit Judah, and they did come down the Jordan Valley. And there are a couple of key areas in the Jordan Valley that did feel their wrath, so this may be a reference to the Roman legions coming down that Jordan Valley. One of those areas was the Qumran settlement, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. In fact, many scholars think the Dead Sea Scrolls were hidden in these caves here in order to preserve them and keep them from being destroyed by the Romans. So this is the Qumran settlement, which was destroyed in AD 70. There's another view of it from the close-up of the ruins. And in the background, you can see the Dead Sea right down there. So this is one of the lowest places on earth. And they felt the wrath of the Roman legions. Then, after the fall of Jerusalem, there was another key area that felt the wrath of Rome. Recognize that? Masada. A little further down the down south, down the Jordan Valley, and you come to the last stand of the Zealots. And the Romans took them, I believe, 3 years to conquer that. There's the Roman ramp going up to Masada, where the wall was breached right there. But Masada fell, bringing the first Jewish revolt to an end. And so that could be a reference to what we're seeing here as well. Because verses 1 through 3 will be fulfilled in AD 70. A limited devastation of Judah with a focus on the temple. Now, two reasons for this devastation are now revealed. You see on page 339.2, we take a look at the true shepherd. Now, this is the beginning of the process that's going to fulfill verses 1 through 3. The process that will fulfill verses 1 through 3 begins with the rejection of the true shepherd in verses 4 through 14. This is a very, very important messianic prophecy, so we'll spend a little bit of time on it. And at least one rabbinic commentator sees it as messianic. Rabbi Kimke sees it as messianic, although not all rabbinic commentators do. So the beginning of the process, the end of the process we'll see when we get a little further along. So the section begins with a commission to the prophet, beginning in verse 4. Thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Pasture the flock of slaughter. So Zechariah's God, point 1a there, tells Zechariah to play the role of a shepherd. I want you to play the role of a shepherd. I want you to portray something. Feed this flock that's going to be slaughtered. The flock would be Israel. The flock would be Israel. So we see right from the beginning that the flock is destined for destruction. Slaughter is going to come upon Israel. And that's totally consistent with verses 1 through 3, as you see in point A there. And this will happen in AD 70 by Rome. This will come to pass in AD 70 at the hand of Rome. And by the way, that's a good cross-reference for point B there at the bottom of your page is Daniel 9:26. Good cross-reference, and it's an important cross-reference to know. Now, Daniel 9:26 is the messianic timeline. It tells us exactly when the Messiah is going to appear. Well, actually, more than just 26, but we're going to concentrate only on verse 26 for our purposes this evening. Anyway, as we go through the messianic timeline, Daniel learns that after 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. Toward the end of this 70-week period, the Messiah is going to be killed. Then after the Messiah is killed, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. So we know that the Messiah will be killed, and then the temple will be destroyed. So the key point to know in that Daniel 9:26 is that the Messiah had to come before the destruction of the temple in AD 70. That is a key historical marker. The Messiah had to come before the destruction of the temple in AD 70. He had to come and suffer. And of course, that's exactly what Yeshua did. No other messianic claimant has ever done that. This is not the only place that this timetable comes out, but Daniel 9:26 is a good place. So note that and keep it in mind when you talk to your Jewish friend. The Messiah had to come before the temple was destroyed. And we know exactly when that happened. Okay, let's turn over to page 340. So we know that Zechariah is playing the role of a shepherd. We know the flock of Israel is going to be slaughtered. What's the condition of the flock? We learn that in verse 5. Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished. And each of those who sells them says, "Blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich." And their own shepherds have no pity on them. Point A, the condition of the flock, abandoned by man. Their possessors, those who buy them. Probably a reference to the Romans, the Gentiles. Those who possess them slay them, they kill them. And of course, the Romans didn't feel they were doing anything wrong. They didn't hold themselves guilty because, after all, these Jewish zealots had rebelled against us. We're just putting down a rebellion. So it's quite proper to slaughter them. But then there's a reference to shepherds, and that would be a reference to Jewish leaders. Their own shepherds have no pity on them. They that sell them say, "Blessed be the Lord, for I am rich." So they compromise their leadership in order to grow wealthy. And the Sadducean priests were well known for their wealth and their greed. Probably the most obvious example of that is the bazaar that was set up in the court of the Gentiles in the temple. It was called the Bazaar of the Sons of Annas by the populace. And that's the area that Yeshua cleansed when he cleaned out the temple. He drove the money changers out of the temple. Well, that was set up by the sons of Annas. Annas was a very greedy high priest. And so the leadership of Israel doesn't pity them either. And a good cross-reference for that is John 11, 47 and 48. Here's the reaction of the leadership of Israel when Yeshua is getting more and more well-known. He's performing messianic miracles. Does the leadership hail him as the Messiah and tell the nation to follow him? Here's what the leadership says. In John 11, verse 46, Yeshua has just raised Lazarus from the dead, and many Jewish people are beginning to believe on him as Messiah. And here's the reaction. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, What are we doing? This man is performing many signs. So they acknowledge that Yeshua is performing messianic miracles. But here's their reaction. If we let him go on like this, will the nation will believe in him, and the Messiah will come, and will set up the kingdom. Is that what they say? All men will believe on him. Heaven forbid. And what will happen? The Romans will come and take away our place. That's our power and our nation. So we'll be deposed from our place of authority, and our nation will come under more Roman rule than ever before.
So they must not have believed that Messiah would have any power.
Well, they believed that they didn't want Yeshua to be the Messiah. They rejected him as the Messiah. And so they were following through on that official rejection of his messiahship. So the shepherds and the possessors have abandoned the flock of Israel. But in verse 6, we also see that the flock will be abandoned by God, not only by man, but also by God. Verse 6. For I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I shall cause the men to fall, each into another's power, and into the power of his king. And they will strike the land, and I shall not deliver them from their power. I shall not deliver them from their power. Point B1 there, you see in your notes, I will have no more pity on the inhabitants of the land. And again, that should cause us to jump right back to Hosea, right? The very first minor prophet we studied way back in Hosea chapter 1. Hosea's children become symbols of what the Lord is going to do for Israel. His wife Gomer conceives and gave birth to a daughter, and the Lord said to him, to Hosea, name her Lo Ruhamah. Lo Ruhamah, the word means not pitied, not having compassion. Why? For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I would ever forgive them. So we learned from Hosea when we studied that prophet that there would be a temporary period of time when Israel would be Lo Ruhamah, when Israel would be not pitied. That's repeated here in Zechariah. Verse 8. When she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo Ami. Lo Ami means not my people. Why? For you are not my people, and I am not your God. So that Lo Ruhamah period also has a second name. It's also known as the Lo Ami period, when you are not my people. It's a temporary period of time when Israel is set aside and not pitied, not protected by God. And that's exactly what's being stated here in verse 6. I will not pity Israel. Point 2 there. I'll deliver every man into the hand of his neighbor. A reference to the civil strife of AD 70. And it was the civil war that went on inside the city of Jerusalem that caused its defeat. We destroyed ourselves as much as allowing the Romans to destroy us. There was zealots against zealots, zealot faction against zealot faction during the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. One zealot faction even burned the food of the other faction, increasing the starvation and hardship in the city. They killed each other off so that the able-bodied warriors were tremendously depleted. And this led to a much easier victory by the Romans. And so God says, I'm going to give the flock into what? The hand of his king. Point 3. That would be Caesar. You see in John 19:15, we said we have no king but Caesar. And so into Caesar's hand, God places us. I'd rather fall into the hands of the living God than the hands of man, right? And then the land will be smitten as implied and predicted in the first 3 verses. And there will be no deliverance. God has abandoned the nation. Now Josephus tells us, point A and B at the bottom of your page, that 1,100,000 Jewish people were killed in the first Jewish revolt and 97,000 taken into slavery. And a few people in the morning class wanted that reference, so I've got it here for you. The Josephus reference is Wars of the Jews, Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 9, Section 3. Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 9, Section 3. Josephus tells us the casualty count that came out of the first Jewish revolt. And it came about because the flock had been abandoned by man and abandoned by God. Okay, turn over to page 341. That'd be basically Judah. Judah. Well, yeah, there are a lot more Jewish people in Israel than that. I think the estimated population is around 3 million in those days. Okay, page 341. Zechariah has received his commission. Now he carries out his commission. Verse 7. This is Zechariah. So I pastured the flock doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock. And I took for myself two staves. The one I called favor and the other I called union. And so I pastured the flock. Now Zechariah is going to begin to portray the career of the Messiah, of Yeshua here, the great shepherd, the good shepherd. Now the flock is all Israel, point A. But you notice that there was a distinction made between the flock and the afflicted of the flock. Point B. The offer of the Messiah, the offer of the Good Shepherd, went to the entire flock. But the emphasis is on a particular section of the flock. That would be the poor of the flock. That would be a reference to those who did receive Yeshua as Savior and Messiah. The vast majority of the nation rejected him, followed the line of the leadership. But whoever received him, he gave the power to become the sons of God, right? John chapter 1. And there were a good number of Jewish people who did receive him. They are the poor of the flock. And this is repeated in Matthew 9, 35 and 36 there, your cross reference. You read that section, you'll see that Yeshua's ministry was to the whole nation. But the emphasis was on the distressed and dispirited, on the poor in the flock who rallied to him. Now what does he do? He takes two staves, point C. This is the standard equipment for a shepherd. A shepherd had two pieces of equipment that he carried with him and used on a regular basis. Point one, the one I called beauty, and you see the Hebrew word there, noam, can also be translated graciousness. But the beauty would be the short, thick club, like a baseball bat, that was used for protection. The shepherd carried a short, thick club, and he used it to wail on lions and tigers and bears and thieves, people like that, okay? Kind of like carrying a baseball bat around with him. So we see here that the Messiah wanted to protect Israel. And what did he say? He said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, I wanted to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings." Another picture of the protection that Messiah wanted to give to his people. So he came, and part of his mission was to protect his people. And then he came with another piece of equipment. Point two, the other I called bands, hovelim. The word also can be translated binding. It's a reference to binding things together. So it's a reference to the unity of the flock. This was a longer staff that had a crook in it. And the shepherd would use this kind of a staff to reach out and rescue errant sheep or pull errant sheep back into the fold. So it was used to produce unity in the flock, to hold the flock together. And so the Messiah came with a desire to protect the flock and a desire to bring unity to the flock, to Israel. There's a third aspect to his ministry, point D. He came also to feed the flock. And that's what Zechariah did. He did literally. Yeshua did it through the Word of God. Yeshua taught clear propositional truth during the first half of his ministry. Yeshua taught clear propositional truth during the first half of his ministry. We'll see in just a moment that this changes in the middle of his ministry when he's rejected. But in the first half, he's teaching like the Sermon on the Mount, clear propositional truth. And so Zechariah, as a shepherd, as a literal shepherd, takes these two staves and feeds the flock. He's portraying the Messiah's desire to protect the flock, bring unity to the flock, and feed the flock. But, and it's a big but, what was the reaction? And now we go to verse 8 on page 342. What was the reaction to the Good Shepherd? Verse 8. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul was also weary of me. The shepherd comes and he shepherds the flock, but he meets with conflict and friction. Now it states that he cut off three shepherds in 1 month, probably a reference to three segments of Jewish leadership. Now, this one verse, according to the commentators, has generated, because it's kind of a vague verse here, this one verse has generated at least 40 different positions. And they didn't list them in all the commentators, in all the commentaries. They just, a number of them said there's over 40 positions that different commentators take. So Dr. Fruchtenbaum has put down three of the best options. Point one there, probably a reference to priests, scribes, and elders. Point two, perhaps a reference to civil authorities, priests, and false prophets. Point three, perhaps a reference to scribes and lawyers. They're actually the same group, Sadducees and Pharisees. So Dr. Fruchtenbaum feels that position number three is the best, Pharisees, Sadducees, and scribes or lawyers there. Scribes and lawyers are basically synonymous terms. And those are all very possible positions, but you know, you get 40 Jews together, what do you get? 41 opinions. So guess what? I have my opinion. So I'm going to put up this chart. I believe I made it for you here. Yeah. And you can consider these positions, and you can consider my position with the lot as well. So we've got at least 41 positions here. So you can take notes on this chart. Okay, everybody getting their charts? Everybody got one? Okay, excellent. So I'm giving you what I consider to be strong, four strong possibilities for verse 8. Now we know that Yeshua was the Lamb of God, the Passover Lamb. And we learn as we read Scripture that the Passover lamb was selected on the 10th of Nisan and examined until the 14th of Nisan to see if it was without spot or blemish. And Yeshua followed that pattern at the very end of his last trip to Jerusalem. He entered the city of Jerusalem on the 10th of Nisan with the triumphal entry. And then he was examined in the temple from the 10th of Nisan to the 14th of Nisan by three basic groups of Jewish leadership. He was questioned in regard to his doctrine and his activities. And he survived this intense questioning, and he came out of that examination and was proven to be without spot or blemish in regard to his personal behavior or his doctrine. And part of the sections of Scripture that cover that is Matthew chapter 22. And in Matthew 22, these three groups are mentioned as examining the Messiah and in conflict with the Messiah because they've rejected him. They've rejected Yeshua as the Messiah. And so they're trying to find a way to discredit him. Matthew 22:15-16. Then the Pharisees went out and plotted together how they might trap him in what he said, and they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. So here we have the Pharisees, which are the part of the religious leadership of the nation. The Herodians, which are these are individuals who favored the rule of Herod, and they favored the rule of Rome. The Pharisees hated Herod and hated the role of Rome, but on this issue, the Pharisees and the Herodians unite together. So these two groups are testing him. We drop down to verse 23, we read, on that same day, Sadducees, this is the priestly order. These were the priests who maintained the temple and had a lot of power because of their prominence in the temple. On that day, Sadducees came to Jesus and questioned him. So we see three shepherds of Israel here challenging the Messiah. So that's why I think that's probably the best position to take. You consider these positions. You decide for yourself which one you want to take. But I think number four is the best one. So there's point B there. And by the way, on the final test, when you turn in your 15-page paper, if you take another position other than mine, you have to defend it. 15 pages of defense, okay? All righty. Okay, so he's cutting off these three shepherds, and there's mutual antagonism between him and the shepherds. You see in point B there, it says, for my soul was weary of them, and their soul also loathed me. That word loathed, that is found in the Hebrew text there, means nauseated, to abhor. A very, very strong word. The soul of these three groups of leaders were disgusted with Yeshua. They loathed him. They felt nauseous when he was around. They abhorred him. And that's very consistent with Isaiah 53:3, which says he was despised and forsaken of men. Of the leadership, by the way, Isaiah 53:3 speaks of the leadership there. And this whole contrast, this whole conflict between Jesus and the key leadership of the nation is seen in Matthew chapter 21 through 23. If you want to write that down and read those chapters, you'll see the leadership of the nation coming against him, trying to discredit him. Matthew chapter 21 through 23. Okay, the Messiah is going to come. He wants to protect the nation, unify the nation, feed the nation, and he does that, and he receives conflict. And so we're going to have a result, and that result is going to come in verse 9, but that result is going to, you're going to learn about that result after the break. So go ahead and take the break, and when you hear the shofar, come on back. verse 9. Let's pick it up on verse 9. The Messiah wants to come, protect the flock, unify the flock, teach the flock, and he meets with conflict. And so what is his reaction? Verse 9. Then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. And what is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left eat one another's flesh. All right. What's going on here? What is going on here? Point A1 there. The first thing that happens is a rupture of the good shepherd and the people as a whole. There's going to be a cessation of the feeding here. So the rupture begins with the people as a whole. Mark chapter 3 covers that. Also, Matthew covers this as well. Yeshua is going around Israel, teaching that he's the Messiah, offering the kingdom, performing these miracles, and he's getting a negative reaction. In Mark chapter 3, verse 21, we read, when his own family heard of this, they went out to take custody of him, for they were saying, he has lost his senses. So his own family thinks that Yeshua is going off the deep end and he ought to be restrained. We better go get him. Then between verses 21 and 31 is a nice little section, but we pick it up in verse 31. Then his mother and his brothers arrived, and standing outside, they sent word to him and called him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, behold, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you. And you'd think he'd say, okay, I'll go out and greet mom. Okay, but what does he say? Answering them, he said, who are my mother and my brothers? Looking at those who were sitting around him, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. In other words, Yeshua prioritizes spiritual relationships over physical relationships. In the middle of his ministry, after he was rejected as Messiah, he prioritized spiritual relationships over physical relationships. Those who believed in him and trusted in him, were considered his family. Those of his physical family that thought he was crazy took second place. So there's a rupture with the people. Point two, the Messiah then ended the feeding in order to leave them to the natural course of events. And we learn as we read the Gospels that Yeshua stopped teaching in clear propositional truth and started teaching in parables once he was rejected. And that's what we see in Matthew 13, verses 10 through 13. He stops teaching in clear propositional truth. He speaks in parables, and the disciples have to come to him. And they say, the disciples came to him and said, why do you speak to them in parables? Why have you changed your teaching technique? So Jesus answered them. See, the parables aren't just cute stories. There's a very distinct reason why Yeshua chose to go into parables. Jesus answered them. Here's the reason. To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him more shall be given, and he will have in abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore, I speak to them in parables. Here's the reason. Because while seeing, they do not see. While hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. So Yeshua chose his teaching technique. He spoke in parables to hide the truth from the unbelievers, but he would explain the truth to his disciples. And so the feeding came to a close. Feeding of the flock ended. Then it says, point B, C, and D, that which dies, let it die. That which is cut off, let it cut off. And then comes that weird statement, let everyone eat the flesh of another. What in the world is Zechariah talking about there? Well, it's not a pleasant judgment, but one of the curses of the Mosaic law, one of the curses of the covenant, is the curse of cannibalism. the curse of cannibalism. It's found in Leviticus 26:29 and in Deuteronomy. Here's the section in Leviticus 26. As God goes through the curses of the covenant, "Further, you will eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters you will eat." So that's a pretty straightforward one. But in Deuteronomy, God expands on it a little bit more. Deuteronomy 28:53-57. Again, speaking of the curses of the covenant, "Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you, during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile toward his brother and towards the wife he cherishes and toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give even one of them any of the flesh of his children, which he will eat, since he has nothing else left during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you and all your towns." See, a nice guy like me, okay? Right? Refined and delicate. A nice guy like me will get so hard and callous that he's going to eat his own children and he's not going to share a drumstick with anyone else. Okay. 56, here it gets worse. "The refined and delicate woman among you, who would not venture to set the stole or a foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement." She won't go around barefoot. Okay? She won't even step out of the house. "Shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes and toward her son and daughter and toward her afterbirth, which issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears, for she will eat them secretly for lack of anything else during the siege and the distress by which your enemy will oppress you in your towns." Not exactly devotional reading, is it? Has this ever come upon Israel? The curse of cannibalism has come upon Israel at least three times. For example, we read of the curse of the cannibalism coming during the siege of Samaria. And, oh, I have this chart. Yes, I'm sorry, I forgot to hand it out to you. Here it is. The day crew wanted it, so we made it. So you can owe this pleasant bit of reading to the day class. It's not my fault. I didn't write it. I didn't duplicate it. Oh, I did duplicate it. I was forced to. Okay, everybody got a chart? Okay, the first example of the curse of cannibalism coming upon the Jewish community is the siege of Samaria there, 2 Kings 6, 24 through 29. The second example of when this curse hit the Jewish community for our disobedience is the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC, Jeremiah 19:9, Ezekiel 5:10. You have it on your chart. And the third time it hit is the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Josephus records this, and I do have the Josephus reference down here for you if you want to add it on. It's Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Wars of the Jews, Book 6, Chapter 3, Section 4. Book 6, Chapter 3, Section 4. Now, I've edited down what Josephus writes there in order to get it on this overhead. It's much more extensive than this, but this will give you the idea. Here's what Josephus says. "Now, of those that perished by famine in the city, the number was prodigious, and the miseries they underwent unspeakable. Now, there was a certain woman. The famine pierced through her very bowels and marrow. She then attempted a most unnatural thing, and snatching up her child, she slew her son and roasted him and ate one half of him." So there it is again, the curse of cannibalism. And that's exactly what God is saying here. Let everyone eat the flesh of one another. This will happen in the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. Now, page 343. And you thought the Passion was gory. Just come to Bob's class. Okay, verse 10. First reaction was to stop the feeding. The second response is the breaking of beauty, verse 10. So I took my staff favor and cut it in pieces to break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. Again, a rather strange statement, God breaking a covenant. God is not a covenant breaker. And the language here speaks of a covenant made with the Gentiles, Kol Ha'amim. It's a language that refers to the Gentiles. Now, we know God has covenants with the Jewish people, but there's no particular covenant God has made with the Gentiles. This is probably not a reference to the Noahic covenant. That would be about the only one. What in the world is he talking about here? Well, he's probably talking about an indirect, informal agreement or arrangement that God has with the Gentiles that prevents them from destroying the Jewish people. The fact that he is going to protect Israel automatically sets up the idea that the Gentiles can only go so far. And since beauty is the staff that was designed to protect the flock, since he breaks beauty, then basically he's saying, Gentiles, you can have free reign with Israel. Now, this word broken in the NASB and in your text here is kind of a strong word. It gives you the idea that God is reneging on his covenant, but a better rendering of that word would be annulled or invalidated. Invalidated. And since Israel has broken their covenant with God, and he is allowing the Gentiles to come in and destroy the nation on the basis of the curses of that covenant, this informal, understood, indirect covenant with the Gentiles would be annulled, would be invalidated, and they would be allowed to come in and destroy Israel. And so the protection is removed from Israel. Point C there, fulfilled at the time of the break in Matthew 12:22-45. Basically, that's when Yeshua, the record of Yeshua being rejected as Messiah. Now, what's the effect of the breaking of this staff on this group known as the poor of the flock? They were singled out earlier, identified earlier. What do they think of it? Verse 11. So it was broken on that day. This is the staff favor. It was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized it was the word of the Lord. So again, annulled. It was broken on that day. Again, it was annulled or invalidated. And so the faithful remnant, the Jewish believers of the first century, when they saw the Romans come against Jerusalem, they knew that this came from God. That's the reaction. They knew that it was the word of Jehovah. They knew that what Jesus had said was true, and that this came from God. And they responded properly to it, and that's point C. It was fulfilled in the flight to Pella in AD 70. The fact that the four of the flock understood this properly is fulfilled by the flight to Pella in AD 70. Now, what am I talking about there? If you have room somewhere, if you have a piece of paper, I want to talk a little bit about the first Jewish revolt from 66 to 70 AD. And so if you want to take notes on this, I know there's not much room on your exegetical outline notes, but here's what happened in regard to that. This is a very critical event in Jewish history and in the history of Jewish believers. First Jewish revolt against Rome. Now, the revolt was triggered by a Roman attack on the Jewish citizens of Caesarea. This is Caesarea on the coast where the Romans headquartered their government. So it was an attack on the Jewish citizens of Caesarea, and the Jewish community retaliated by slaughtering the Roman garrison in Jerusalem. Now, this happened in the year 66. And the Messianic Jews, the Jewish believers of the period, were caught in a dilemma. And the dilemma was this: should we fight or should we not fight? Do we join this rebellion or stay out of it? And the dilemma was found in the prophecy of Luke 21, verses 20-24. Here's what Luke 21 states. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, recognize that her desolation is near. Those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babes in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now, the Messianic Jews knew that because of the rejection of the Messiahship of Yeshua, that Jerusalem was destined for destruction. The flock was the flock of slaughter. Now, the sign that they were looking for that this is going to happen is Jerusalem surrounded by armies. When you see Jerusalem surrounded, she's on the verge of destruction. So they knew that her desolation was at hand. And they were instructed by Luke 21, if you're in the city, you've got to get out. If you're outside the city, don't dare go in it. And those of you that are outside the city need to leave the country. You need to leave the country. So because of Luke chapter 21, the Messianic Jews felt they could not take up arms and defend the city of Jerusalem and defend the country against the Romans. They followed the principle that spiritual priorities supersede physical priorities. We have to obey what Yeshua says, no matter what our brothers and sisters think. Now, what happened? When the revolt broke out, the Roman general, Cestus Gallus, came with his armies and surrounded the city. He came from Caesarea on the coast, where he was headquartered, and he came up through the Judean hills, and he surrounded the city of Jerusalem. That was the sign the Messianic Jews were looking for. They saw that event as a fulfillment of Luke chapter 21, 20 through 24. The problem was they were caught inside the city. How in the world can we leave the city when it's surrounded by Romans? Well, it so happened that Cestus Gallus advanced too quickly, and he didn't do a good job of securing his supply lines from Jerusalem down to the coast. And so Jewish guerrilla forces began cutting his supply lines very seriously between Caesarea and Jerusalem. So he thought it better to lift the siege and head back and secure his positions first. Now, on the way back to Caesarea, he was killed. So for a period of about 2 years, the siege of Jerusalem was lifted. There was initial siege of Jerusalem. It was then lifted for 2 years, and what did the Messianic Jews do? Every single one of them packed up. Those that were in the city left the city. Those that were in Judea, and they followed they obeyed Luke 21, and they left the country. They went across the Jordan River. They went north to the city of Pella. They eventually settled in the city of Pella and waited out the war in Pella. Now in 68 AD, 2 years later, 68 AD, the Romans are back. They're back under Vespasian. Then when Vespasian is called to Rome to become emperor, Titus takes over. And in 78 AD, the city of Jerusalem is destroyed. 70. They started the second siege began in 68 and was finished up in 70. Okay. Now we have a parallel report by Eusebius, who's a third century church historian. And I'm going to put up here a quote from Ecclesiastical History. Ecclesiastical History is his history book that he wrote. And this is what he writes about it. The Christians of the Jerusalem community, so that's the Jewish believers of the Jerusalem community, through a prediction revealed to multiple people of this church, had received a warning to immigrate from there before the outbreak of the war and go to a region in the Jordan called Pella. And in fact, leaving Jerusalem, they took refuge in the place indicated. So the regal capital of Judea and the whole region were left without the saints. And so everybody left. He goes on quoting, and he quotes an even earlier historian, a Jewish Christian named Hegesippus. Hegesippus' history has been lost. But he points out that not one single Jewish Christian lost his life in the first Jewish revolt because they left the country and the city in total. And remember, Josephus tells us that 1,100,000 Jews were killed during the First Roman War, but Eusebius tells us that not a single Hebrew Christian was among that number. That's because they obeyed the prophecy of Luke chapter 21. They obeyed it, and Luke 21 deals with the staff favor being broken, protection over Israel being broken. And by the way, doesn't this verse take on amazing impact when you learn that cannibalism stalked the city? Woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress. Can you imagine some of these mothers and what they went through during that siege, that two-year siege of Jerusalem? All right, let's move on. We're on page 343 in the middle of the page. And we move on to verse 12, which is the attitude of the Jewish leaders. That the flock, poor of the flock, reacted in one way with faith. How did the Jewish leaders react? Another group, verse 12. I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages. If it is not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. So Zechariah is going to go get his pay here. And in point B, they weigh him 30 pieces of silver. Point 1, B1, is your key point. The 30 pieces of silver is the price of contempt, because it is the price of a dead slave. Exodus 21:32. It is the price of a dead slave. It would have been better for the leaders to obey the statement of verse 12. If it's good in your sight, give me my wages. If not, never mind. Don't give me anything if you don't like my ministry. That would have been the better thing to do, not to give him anything. But instead, they heap this insult upon him, the price of a dead slave. See, in Exodus 21:32, if an ox kills your neighbor's slave, you have to compensate the neighbor for the loss of the slave. A free man or a healthy slave was worth twice that amount. A healthy free man or a healthy slave was worth 60 shekels of silver. So this is an insult. It would have been better to do nothing, to pay him nothing. And now in verse 13 on page 344, another commission comes to the prophet. First part of verse 13. Then the Lord said to me, and I've got to read this with a lot of sarcasm. Then the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So God tells Zechariah to take this 30 pieces of silver, this price of contempt, and throw it into the potter's area of the temple compound. Now, the potter was one of the lowest of the laboring classes in Israel, and apparently they had some area set apart for them to either make or sell their wares that were used in the temple there. And notice, point C, the goodly price that I was prized by them. Strong sarcasm there. And notice who's being prized. Is it Zechariah? No, it's God himself. It's God himself who's being insulted. Point 4 at the bottom. This is fulfilled in Matthew 26, verses 14 through 16, where Judas receives the 30 pieces of silver to betray Yeshua. So sometimes prophets don't have to do the most fun thing. Here, Zechariah is portraying Judas the betrayer. He carries out the commission in verse 13, point B, last part of the verse. So I took the 30 shekels of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. And so Zechariah now very clearly portrays what Judas did, and it's fulfilled on point C there. Judas tosses the 30 pieces of silver into the temple. And so the protection over Israel is removed. And then in verse 14, the next response is the removal of unity. Verse 14. Then I cut in pieces my second staff, union, to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. And so point B1 there, toward the bottom of the page, the unity of the Jews is destroyed. Factions formed. Factions fought against each other inside besieged Jerusalem. I've talked about that earlier, and the civil strife, point C, caused Jerusalem to fall to Rome. And the result was that the diaspora began. Zechariah 13, 7 through 9 will bring that out clearer. And so the process of the worldwide diaspora that we've suffered over the last 2,000 years began in AD 70 with the breaking of union. Now, page 345. We've got a summary of verses 1 through 14 at the top of the page, and then we finish up. The summary, here's what's happened so far. One, before the destruction, the Messiah will come. Before 70 AD, the Messiah will be on the scene. Point two, the remnant will follow him. This is the poor of the flock. These are the believers. Just the remnant will follow him. The majority will not. The majority will not. The majority, the others, point three, the majority will value him equal to a dead slave. They will reject him, be nauseated by him, abhor him. And there will be a consequence. The nation will be given over to the Gentiles and scattered. And point five, reiterates the point that the Messiah is the good shepherd. That's what John, in John 10, when Yeshua is speaking in John 10, 11 through 18, he's saying, I am the good shepherd. He's identifying with this section of Zechariah.
Was there anywhere indicated how big the remnant was?
No. At this point, no, we don't know. I have an estimate in our next little section dealing with the second Jewish revolt, but I don't know of any estimates as the number of believers in 70 AD. Okay, now we move on to verses 15 through 17. We come to the second reason why verses 1 through 3, way back at the beginning, are going to be fulfilled. This is the sequel, the conclusion of the process that verses 1 through 3 summarized. Okay? With verses 15, 16, and 17, that the process is going to come to completion. So 1 through 3, a summary. 4 through 14, the beginning of the process. 15 through 17, the end of the process. So let's start with verse 15. Another commission comes to Zechariah. The Lord said to me, take again for yourself the equipment of a foolish shepherd. So he plays a second role, point one. Now it's going to be a foolish shepherd. And that word foolish in the Hebrew does not mean the guy is a little bit off in the mental area. Okay, it doesn't mean that he's not educated or he can't learn or he's a little bit touched. The word there means morally deficient or corrupt. Morally deficient or corrupt. So this foolish shepherd is basically he's an immoral, ungodly man. Play the part of an ungodly shepherd, not a good shepherd. And he's going to take the same instruments, point B there. He's going to take a short club, and he's going to take a long staff with a crook in it. The good shepherd used those two items of equipment properly. The foolish shepherd is going to use them improperly. Two very different results will come about. Now, the reason and the purpose for Zechariah playing this role now, verse 16. For behold, I am going to raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for the perishing, seek the scattered, heal the broken, or sustain the one standing, but will devour the flesh of the fat sheep and tear off their hooves. Again, not a very pretty picture. So this shepherd that's going to be raised up is going to be exactly the opposite of the good shepherd, the opposite of Yeshua. He will not do what a shepherd should do. What should a shepherd do? Points A, B, C, and D. He should visit. He should seek. He should heal. He should feed. That's what the good shepherd should do. Points A, B, C, and D. Instead, what will he do? He will eat and he will destroy. He will be cruel and brutal. He will destroy the flock in a cruel and brutal manner. So point two, at the bottom of the page, the foolish shepherd will arise and be accepted, but he will not do the things the good shepherd did. Who is this foolish shepherd? Can we pinpoint who he is? I think we can. Point three, Simon Bar Kokhba in AD 132 to 135. So that brings me to the point where I need to talk about the second Jewish revolt. So again, find some room somewhere, and we'll talk about the second Jewish revolt, or the Bar Kokhba revolt. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, now some people feel that this is a reference to the Antichrist. I feel that Bar Kokhba is a better alternative. Now, what's the Bar Kokhba revolt? The Bar Kokhba revolt, or the second Jewish revolt, lasted from 132 to 135 AD. 132 to 135 AD. Now, the cause of the revolt was Hadrian, Emperor Hadrian's announcement that he wanted to rebuild Jerusalem, because Jerusalem hadn't yet recovered from the destruction of AD 70. He wanted to rebuild Jerusalem, and he wanted to rename it Aelia Capitolina, after himself and after his Jupiter, the king of the gods there, and he wanted to turn it into a Gentile town. I have this great city development plan for Jerusalem, where the Jews were not impressed with his city development plan, and we revolted. Now, initially, the Messianic community, the Messianic Jews, joined the revolt because there was no prohibition to keep them out of it. The prohibition of the first Jewish revolt was no longer valid. Matthew 21 was a thing of the past. Now, it's estimated. Now, here's an estimate for you, Sandy. It's estimated by some scholars that up to 30% of the Jewish community were believers at this time. Up to 30%. Why? Because those who did believe in Yeshua and who had witnessed the destruction of the temple used it as a great apologetic. Between 70 and 135 AD, they were in the synagogue saying, Yeshua said the temple would be destroyed. It happened. Yeshua is the Messiah. And it's estimated that up to 30% believed. So that's a significant section of the people. Not a majority by any means, but still a significant section. Now, the leader of the revolt was a man named Simon Bar Kokhba. Simon Bar Kokhba. Simon the son of Kokhba. Now, initially, he was very successful in defeating the Romans. This revolt lasted 3 years, and at about the halfway point, about 1.5 years had gone by, and Simon Bar Kokhba was very successful, and so Rabbi Akiva, the leading Torah rabbi of the day, declared that Simon Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. Rabbi Akiva proclaimed Bar Kokhba the Messiah. And he went further than that. He renamed Simon Bar Kokhba. He changed his name to Simon Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba, Simon the son of a star. Not Simon the son of Kokhba anymore, but Simon the son of a star. Kokhba means star. He based the name on the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 24:17. Numbers 24:17. In which the Messiah is associated with a star in Numbers 24:17. So this is the Messiah. Once he did that, the whole nature of the revolt changed. It wasn't merely a nationalistic revolt over some disgusting modifications in the nature of Jerusalem. This was now a religious battle under the Messianic banner of Bar Kokhba. What did the Messianic Jews do? They did the same thing that that Yeshua did and that their contemporaries before them did. They prioritized spiritual relationships over physical relationships, and they withdrew from the army. They were not going to fight the Romans under the messianic banner of Bar Kokhba. Now, if it's true that 30% of the population were believers, then possibly 30% of the army were believers. And if that's true, 30% of your soldiers going AWOL would definitely weaken your army. They withdrew from the army was significantly weakened, and the whole nature of the rebellion changed at this point, and the Romans, in the next year and a half, crushed the rebellion. In the year 135, Bar Kokhba was isolated in the city of Beitar. Beitar became his last stand, and he was killed in Beitar. Now, the Messianic Jews were heavily criticized for their decision, and the term Meshumadim, Meshumad, destroyer, was applied to the Jewish believers. So that's why we're called Meshumadim even today. That's why you hear people like myself called Meshumad, you're a destroyer, because this is where it came from. Now, how did the Jewish community react to the defeat of Bar Kokhba? Well, they reacted to Bar Kokhba's defeat by changing his name. One more time. Here's the names of Bar Kokhba. His original name was Bar Kosiva, Simon the son of Kosiva. That was the name his mama gave him, okay? That was the name he got, Simon son of Kosiva. Rabbi Akiva gave him a different name, Simon Bar Kokhba, Simon son of Asar, Simon the Messiah, Numbers 24:17. And you notice the play on words, Kosiva and Kokhba being very similar. What did the Jewish community do after he was defeated? They renamed him Simon Bar Kosiva, son of a lie. Son of a lie. That was the final name. Because he was not the Messiah. He was a false Messiah. He was the son of a lie.
How come they discredited Akiva?
Akiva was not discredited for that. He just made a goof. That's the way the Jewish community looks at him today. Oh, anyone can make a mistake. Oops, you want that up still? Okay. All right. It was a real simple chart, so I figured you'd be able to just whip it right down there. Okay. All right, we've just got a few minutes, but we've got one verse to go. And we'll finish up on verse 17. I'll leave that up for another few seconds. So this foolish shepherd is raised up, and then on page 346, verse 17, this foolish shepherd will be judged. Woe to the worthless shepherd who leaves the flock. A sword will be on his arm and on his right eye. His arm will be totally withered. His right eye will be blind. Point 2A, a reference to his arm. His arm will be dried up. The arm of the shepherd should have been used to protect the flock. It should have used that staff called beauty and battered the enemy. So his arm corresponds to beauty. He didn't protect the flock. His eye will be darkened. His eye should have been used to watch the flock and see that it doesn't scatter. So this corresponds to that staff called bands or unity. And so judgment will come upon the false shepherd. And so Bar Kokhba was defeated and killed. What were the results of the Bar Kokhba revolt? Number 3 at the bottom of the page. With the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt, A, the depletion of the land begins its final phase. During the second Jewish revolt, the Romans were disgusted with these stubborn Jews. We were the only country that revolted against them. And so instead of being gentle with us, they followed a scorched earth policy this time, all the way from Galilee down to Judea. They burned everything. They just destroyed the land. The land sunk into a wasteland. Point A there. Secondly, the land was renamed Palestine. which means the land of the Philistines. That was Hadrian's insult to the Jewish community. That was Hadrian's attempt to eradicate even the memory of our presence in that territory. So you wonder where the name Palestine came from. It came from Hadrian as a result of the second Jewish revolt. And the name is still with us today. Thirdly, Jerusalem became off limits to all Jews. D, Jerusalem was rebuilt and turned into a Gentile city and renamed Aelia Capitolina, just as Hadrian wanted. And it stayed that way for a short time. I'd have to dig out my Jerusalem history books to find out how long it stayed Aelia Capitolina. Point E, add a point E. Point E, Israel was taken into the worldwide diaspora that we experienced for the next 2,000 years. The process of scattering Israel all over the world was completed in 135 AD. We were taken into the worldwide diaspora. Only a tiny, tiny, minuscule, insignificant remnant remained in the land. We were not totally out of the land, but it was only a few of us. Okay, I've said that I don't believe that the foolish shepherd is the Antichrist, and I want to tell you why here. And I'm going to do that using Daniel 9, 26 and 27. Why don't I believe that the foolish shepherd is the Antichrist? Well, in Daniel 9, 26 and 27, we have that messianic timetable. And we've already seen that after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. So after the death of the Messiah, something happens. The people of the prince who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. So I've grayed down this reference to the prince who is to come, and I want to emphasize, people will come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. Who were they? We know who they were. It was the Romans. Okay, Gentiles, AD 70. That's the people. Now, let's reread the verse again, but this time emphasizing the other section of it. The people of the prince who is to come. There's a prince who's coming, and his people are Romans. In other words, he's a Roman prince, a Gentile prince. He's coming. And in verse 27, we know who he is. And he, referring back to the prince, and he will make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. And in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. The Antichrist is the one who comes in the middle of the 70th week of Daniel, the final week of Daniel. He is the one that makes the firm covenant with many in Israel. He is the prince of the Romans. Okay, so the Antichrist will not be a Jew. The Antichrist will be a Gentile of Roman origin. And so I don't believe that the foolish shepherd is the Antichrist at all. I believe it is Bar Kokhba. Now I'm going to keep you guys over just a few minutes because we've come to the end of a section here, and it's a good time just to quickly think some thoughts of application. So here's an application chart.
Are you thinking the Antichrist is going to be Italian?
Not necessarily. Now, yes, Rome, Italy, is the headquarters of the Roman Empire, but the Roman Empire is now spread out and will be a worldwide empire. It's the final empire. It will dominate the world. The United States comes out of Rome. So does all of the Western Hemisphere, basically. So he could be an American. He could be anybody. He'll be a Gentile who have Roman roots. That's all we can say. But maybe it's Juan Carlos of Spain. No, yeah, a lot of people said he's the Antichrist. I don't know why, but all kinds of crazy ideas. This is why the Antichrist will have to be revealed. We're not going to be able to figure out who the Antichrist is. He will be revealed, the Scripture says. Okay, let's take a look at some quick thoughts of application, and we'll let you go. We've looked at Zechariah 9 through 11. And the theme I wanted to pick up was the description of the Messiah as the cornerstone, the tent peg, and the battle bow. The biblical application. When the Lord returns to Israel, the Messiah of the tribe of Judah will be Israel's cornerstone, or the foundation of their salvation. He will be Israel's tent peg. Everything that they consider important will hang on him. And three, he will be Israel's battle bow, the power to defeat their enemies. But is that just something in the future? Is that something that just lies somewhere out there in the great beyond that has nothing to do with us today? Well, no. The Messiah is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And these principles can apply to our lives as well. So personal application. Is Yeshua your cornerstone? Is he the single most important item in your spiritual salvation? Are you trusting nothing but him? You're not trusting in the church. You're not trusting in good works. You're not trusting in your baptism. You're trusting in your relationship with Yeshua and Yeshua alone. Is he your cornerstone? Is he your tent peg? Do you have everything that is meaningful to you hanging on him? First of all, your sorrows, 1 Peter 5, do they hang on him? Do you let him bear your concerns, your anxieties, your joys, your talents, your possessions, your affections, your loves? See, all our best belongs to Yeshua, who purchased us with his own blood. You know, if we hang our life on this world, if we hang our life on our job or on our relatives or on our money or on our car or whatever crazy thing we hang our life on, we're going to meet with deep disappointment, aren't we? It's all going to let us down.